instantly. The locals are overjoyed. Every night I hear the high-pitched whine of snowmobiles speeding past my apartment. There are things I will need to survive the winter. Salt, a shovel, a new toilet seat, rope. I brave the weather and go to the hardware store. I'm wearing boots, laced high around my calves, a coat, gloves, hat, and scarf, thermal underwear. I never remove these items unless I am home. It takes too much effort. I wonder how these people manage to reproduce. I see Magnus standing over a display of chainsaws. He is more handsome than I remember. I turn to walk away, but then I don't. I stand still and hope he notices me. I realize that, dressed as I am, my own family wouldn't recognize me. I tap his shoulder. I say, "What do you plan on massacring?" He looks up slowly, shrugs. "Just looking," he says.
"For a victim?"
"Aren't you feeling neighborly?"
I thought I would say hello.
Magnus nods again. "You've said hello." I swallow, hard. My irritation tastes bitter. I quickly tell him my phone number and go to find a stronger kind of rope. As I pull away, I notice Magnus watching me from inside the store. I smile. In my lab, things make sense. I teach my students how to make perfect concrete cylinders, how to perform compression tests. They crush their perfect cylinders and roar with delight each time the concrete shatters and the air is filled with a fine dust. There's a lot to love about breaking things. Everyone I meet dispenses a bit of wisdom on how to survive the difficult winters. Embrace the outdoors, drinking, travel, drinking, sun lamps, drinking, sex, drinking. The hydrologist offers to prepare spicy curries to keep me warm, offers to give me a taste of his very special curry. I decline, tell him I have a delicate constitution. Nils, my department chair, stops by my office. He says, "How are you holding up?" I assure him all is well. He says, "First year is always the hardest." He says, "You might want to take a trip to Detroit to see your family." I thank him for the support. I'm walking around the lab watching students work when Magnus calls. I excuse myself and take the call in the hallway, ignoring the students smelling about with their aimless expressions. My heart beats loudly. I can hardly hear Magnus. I say, "You didn't need to take so long to call me."
"Is this a lecture?"
"Would you like it to be?"
"Can I make you dinner?"
I ignore my natural impulse to say no. I am more excited than I would ever admit. He invites me back to his trailer, where he prepares steak and green beans and baked potatoes. We drink beer. We talk. Or rather, I talk, filling his trailer with all the words I've kept to myself since moving to the North Country. I complain about the weather. At some point, he holds my hand open and I slide my hand in his. He traces my knuckles with his thumb. He is plain-spoken and honest. His voice is strong and clear. He has a kind smile and a kind touch. He talks about his job as a logger and his band. He plays guitar. When we finally stop talking, he says,
"I like you."
And then he stands and pulls me to my feet. A man has never told me he likes me. Like is more interesting than love. I stand on his boots and wrap my arms around him. He is thick and solid. When we kiss, he is gentle. Too gentle. I say, "You don't have to be soft with me." And he grunts. He clasps my neck with one of his giant hands and kisses me harder, his lips forcing mine open. The flat softness of his tongue thrills me. He brushes his lips across my chin. He sinks his teeth into my neck and I grab his shirt between my fists. I try to remain standing. I say,
"My neck is the secret password."
He bites my neck harder and I forget about everything. And all the noise in my head quiets. I slip out of my shirt and step out of my jeans, and Magnus lifts me up and sits me on the edge of his kitchen table. He places his large hands between my thighs and pulls them apart. I quickly unbuckle his belt, reach for him, and he grabs my wrist. He says,
"You don't get to be the boss of everything."
I say a silent prayer. I close my eyes and he drags his hand from my chin, down the center of my chest, over the flat of my stomach. He kisses my shoulders, my breasts, my knees. He makes me tremble and whimper.
"You don't have to be soft with me," I repeat.
Magnus kisses the insides of my ankles and then my lips, his tongue rough and heavy against mine. I try to pull him into me by wrapping my legs around his waist. He laughs low and deep. He says,
"Say you want this."
I bite my lower lip. I measure my pride against my desire. When he fucks me, he is slow, deliberate, rough in a terribly controlled way. I bury my face in his shoulder. When he asks why I'm crying, I say nothing. For a little while, he fills all the emptiness. In the morning, I want to leave quickly, even though I can still feel Magnus in my skin. As I sit on the edge of the bed and pull my pants on, he says,
"I want to see you again."
I say, "Yes," but explain we have to keep things casual, that we can't become a thing, though I don't give him a reason. I don't have one. Not one that would make any kind of sense. He traces my naked spine with his fingers and I shiver. He says,
"We're already a thing."
I stand, shaking my head angrily. "That's not even possible."
He says, "Sometimes, when I'm miles deep in the woods, looking for a new cutting site, it feels like I'm the first man who's ever been there. I look up and the trees are so thick, I can hardly see the sky. I get so scared. But the world somehow makes sense there. Being with you feels like that."
I shake my head again, my fingers trembling as I finish getting dressed. I feel nauseated and dizzy. I say, "I'm allergic to cats." I say, "You shouldn't talk like that," I say. "I like you too." I recite his words over and over for the rest of the day, week, month. Several weeks later, I'm at Magnus's trailer. We've seen each other almost every night at his place, where he cooks and we talk and we have sex. We're lying naked in his narrow bed. I say, "If this continues much longer, we're going to have to sleep at my place. I have a real bed and actual rooms with doors." He smiles and nods. He says,
"Whatever you want."
After Magnus falls asleep, I stare up at the low ceiling, then out the small window at the clear winter sky. I wonder what he would think of Amelia, if he could love her. I try to swallow the emptiness. I hold my stomach as hot tears slide down my face and trickle along my neck. Just as I'm falling asleep, his alarm goes off. Magnus sits up, rubbing his eyes. Even in the darkness, I can see his hair standing on end. He says,
"I want to show you something."
We dress, but he tells me I can leave my coat. Instead, he hands me a quilt. Outside, a fresh blanket of snow has fallen. The moon is still high. Everything is perfect and silent and still. The air hurts, but feels clean. He cuts a trail to the barn, and I follow in his footsteps. As Magnus walks, he stares up into the sky. I tell myself, I feel nothing.
It's a lie. When I'm with him, I feel everything. Inside the barn, I shiver and dance from foot to foot, trying to stay warm. He says,
"We have to milk the cows."
He nods to a small camp stool next to a very large cow. I say, "There is absolutely no way." Magnus leads me to the stool and forces me onto it. He hunches down behind me and he pats the cow on her side. He hasn't shaved yet, so the stubble from his beard tickles me. He kisses my neck softly. He places his hands over mine, and I learn how to milk a cow. Nothing makes sense here. Hunting season starts. Magnus shows me his rifle. Long, polished, powerful. He refers to his rifle as a she and a her. I tease him about his rifle and call her his mistress. He frowns, says he would never do that to me. I believe him. I tell him my father hunts, and he gets excited. He says, "Maybe someday your father and I can hunt together." I explain that my father hunts pheasant, and by hunt, I mean he rides around with his friends on a four-wheeler but doesn't really kill much of anything, and often gets injured in embarrassing accidents. I say, "You and he hunt differently." He says,
"I still want to meet your father."
"I introduce only serious boyfriends to my family," I say. Magnus holds my chin between two fingers and looks at me hard. It makes me shiver. This is the first time I've seen real anger from him. I wonder how far I can push. He says,
"You won't see me for a few days. But I'm going to kill a buck for you."
5 days later, Magnus shows up at my apartment still wearing his camouflage and Carhartt overalls. His beard is long and unkempt. He smells rank. He is dirty. I recognize only his eyes. Magnus steps inside and pulls me into a muscular hug that makes me feel like he's rearranging my insides. I inhale deeply. I am surprised by the sharp twinge between my thighs. When he kisses me, he is possessive, controlling, salty. He moans into my mouth and turns me around, pinning my arms over my head. He fucks me against the front door. I smile. Afterward, we both sink to the floor. He says,
"The buck is in the car."
He says,
"I missed you."
I want to say something. The right thing. The kind thing. I slap his thigh. I push. I say, "Please take a shower." I don't shower, though. Not for hours. I visit my parents in Florida for Thanksgiving, and my mother asks why I don't call as often. I explain how work has gotten busy. I explain how snow has fallen every single day for more than a month, and how everyone thinks I'm from Detroit. My mother says I look thin. She says I'm too quiet. We don't talk about the dead child or the father of the dead child. There is this life and that life. We pretend that life never happened. It is a mercy. Magnus calls every morning before he leaves for work and every night before he falls asleep. One afternoon he calls, and my mother answers my phone. I hear her laughing as she says, "What an unusual name." When she hands me my phone, she asks, "Who is this Magnus? Such a nice young man." I push. I say, "He's no one important," because I don't know how to explain him or who I am when I'm with him. I say it a little too loudly. When I put my phone to my ear, I can hear only a dial tone. Magnus doesn't call for the rest of my trip. We won't speak until the end of January. In my lab, things make sense, but they don't. I can't concentrate.
I want to call Magnus, but my repeated bad behavior overwhelms me. The weather has grown colder, sharper. The world grows, and I shrink. My students work on final projects. I have a paper accepted at a major conference. The semester ends, I return to Florida for the holidays. My mother says I look thin. She says I'm too quiet. When she asks if I want to talk about my child, I shake my head. I say, please, don't ever mention her again. Not ever. My mother holds the palm of one hand to my cheek and the palm of the other over my heart. I send Magnus a card and a letter and a gift and another letter offering apologies, admitting that we very much are a thing, admitting that I long for him. He sends me a text message that says, I'm still angry. I send more letters. He writes back once, and I carry his letter with me everywhere. I try to acquire a taste for venison. The new semester starts. I have another paper accepted at a conference, this one in Europe. A new group of students try to flirt with me while learning about the wonder of concrete. I get a research grant, and my department chair offers me a tenure-track faculty position with the department. He tells me to take as much time as I need to consider his offer. He says the department really needs someone like me. He says, you kill two birds with one stone, Katie. I contemplate placing his head in the compression testing machine and the sound it would make. I say, I prefer to be called Kate. The hydrologist corners me in my lab late one night and makes an inappropriate advance that leaves me unsettled. For weeks, I will feel his long, skinny fingers, how they grabbed at things that were not his to hold. Even though it's after midnight, I call Magnus. My voice is shaking. He says, you hurt my feelings. And the simple honesty of his words hurts. I say, I'm sorry. I never say what I really feel. And I cry. He asks, what's wrong? He knows me better than I care to admit. I tell him about the married hydrologist, a dirty man with a bright pink tongue who tried to lick my ear and called me Black Beauty, and who got aggressive when I tried to push him away, and how I'm nervous about walking to my car. Magnus says, I'm on my way. I wait for him by the main entrance, and when I recognize his bulky frame trudging through the snow toward me, everything feels more bearable. Magnus doesn't say a word. He just holds me. After a long while, he punches the brick wall and says, I'm going to kill that guy. I believe him. He walks me to my lab to get my things. At my apartment, I hold a bag of frozen corn against Magnus's scraped knuckles. I say, I shouldn't have called. He says,
yes, you should have.
He says,
you have to be nicer to me.
I say, I do. I straddle his lap and kiss his torn knuckles and pull his hands beneath my shirt and look into his beautiful blue-gray eyes, and I don't say it, but I think, I love you. Magnus starts picking me up from work every night. And if I have to work late, he sits with me watching me work. There is an encounter with the hydrologist. Words are exchanged. Magnus clarifies for the hydrologist my disinterest in curries of any kind. He doesn't trouble me again. While I work, Magnus tells me about trees and everything a man could ever know from spending his days among them. He often smells like pine and sawdust. In March, winter lingers. Magnus builds me an igloo, and inside, he lights a small fire. He says,
sometimes, I feel I don't know a thing about you.
I'm sitting between his legs, my back to his chest. Even though we're wearing layers of clothing, it feels like we're naked. I say, "You know I'm not very nice." He kisses my cheek. He says,
"That's not true."
He says,
"Tell me something true."
I tell him how I hold on to the idea of Amelia, even though I shouldn't. How she's all I really think about. How she might be trying to walk now or say her first words. I tell him I think I love him. And I love how he likes me. He brings my cold fingers to his warm lips. He fills all the hollow spaces.
How these things come to pass.
Hannah does her best thinking late at night, when all the usurpers living in her house are asleep. If it isn't winter, which is not often, she climbs out onto her roof with a pack of cigarettes and a lighter. She smokes and stares up at the blue-black night sky. She lives in the North Country, where the stars make sense. Hannah shares her home with her unemployed husband, her twin sister, her sister's husband, their son, and her father. She is the only one who works. Mornings, she waits tables at the Koivu Cafe, and nights, she tends bar at Carpella's Supper Club. She leaves most of her tips at her best friend Laura's house. Hannah is plotting her escape. The most popular dish at the Koivu is the panukaku, a Finnish pancake. If old Larson is too hungover, Hannah will heat the iron skillet in the oven and mix the batter. First eggs, beating them lightly, slowly adding the honey, salt, and milk. Finally sifting the flour in. She enjoys the ratchet sound as she pulls the sift trigger. She sways from side to side and imagines she is a flamenco dancer. She is in Spain where it's warm, where there is sun and beauty. Hannah likes making panukaku with extra butter, so the edges of the pancakes are golden and crisp. Sometimes she'll carefully remove the edges from a pancake and eat them just like that. She's still in Spain, eating bread from a panaderia, perhaps enjoying a little wine. Then she'll hear someone shout, "Order up!" And she is no longer in Spain. She is in the middle of nowhere, standing over a hot, greasy stove. Peter, Hannah's husband, comes in for breakfast every morning. Hannah saves him a spot at the counter, and she takes his order. He stares down her uniform, ogling her cleavage and waggling his eyebrows. She feigns affection, smacks his head with her order pad, and hands his ticket to old Larson, who growls,
"We don't do any damn substitutions."
But then makes Peter 3 eggs over easy, hash browns with onions and cheese, 4 slices of bacon, white toast, and 2 panukaku, slightly undercooked. When his food is ready, Hannah takes a break, sits next to Peter, watches him eat. His beard is growing long. A man without a job doesn't need a clean face, he tells her. She hates watching Peter eat. She hates that he follows her to work. She hates his face. Her husband thinks they are trying to have a child. He wears boxers instead of briefs, though he prefers the security of the latter. Peter once read in a magazine that wearing boxers increased sperm motility. He and Hannah have sex only when the home ovulation kit he bought at Walmart indicates she is fertile. Peter would prefer to have sex every day. Hannah would prefer to never have sex with Peter again, not because she's frigid, but because she finds it difficult to become aroused by a perpetually unemployed man. 2 years ago, Hannah said she was going on vacation with Laura downstate, and instead drove to Marquette and had her tubes tied. She wasn't going to end up like her mother with too many children in a too small house with too little to eat. Despite her best efforts, however, she has found herself living in a too small house with too many people and too little to eat. It is a bitter pill to swallow. When she gets off work at 3 in the afternoon, Hannah goes home, washes the grease and salt from her skin, and changes into something cute, but a little slutty. She heads to the university the next town over. She's 27, but looks far younger. So she pretends she's a student. Sometimes she attends a class in one of the big lecture halls. She takes notes and plays with her hair and thinks about all the things she could have done. Other days, she sits in the library and reads books and learns things so that when she finally escapes, she can be more than a waitress with a great rack in a dead Upper Michigan town. Hannah flirts with boys, because at the Michigan Institute of Technology, there are lots and lots of boys who want nothing more than to be noticed by a pretty girl. She never pretends she's anything but smart. She's too old for that. Sometimes the boys take her to the dining hall or the campus cafe for a snack. She tells them she's in mechanical engineering because Laura is a secretary in that department. Sometimes the boys invite her to their messy dorm rooms, littered with dirty laundry and video game consoles and roommates, or their squalid apartments off campus. She gives them blowjobs and lies with them on their narrow twin beds covered in thin sheets and tells them lies they like to hear. After the boys fall asleep, Hannah heads back across the bridge to Carpella's, where she tends bar until 2 in the morning. Peter visits Hannah at the supper club, too. But he has to pay for his drink, so he doesn't visit often. Don Carpella, the owner, is always around, grabbing at things with his meaty fingers. He is a greedy man and a friend of her father. Even though he's nearing 60, Don is always breathing down Hannah's neck, bumping up against her in the cramped space behind the bar, telling her he'd make her damn happy if she'd leave her old man. When he does that, Hannah closes her eyes and breathes easy because she needs her job. If Peter is around when Don is making his moves, he'll laugh and raise his glass. "You can have her," he'll slur, as if he has a say in the matter. After the bar closes, Hannah wipes everything down and washes all the glasses and empties the ashtrays. She and Laura, who also works at the supper club, will sit on the hood of Hannah's car in the back alley and hold hands. Hannah will lean against Laura's shoulder and inhale deeply and marvel that her friend can still smell good after hours in that dark, smoky space where men don't hear the word no. If the night is empty enough, they will kiss for a very long time until their cold lips become warm, until the world falls away, until their bodies feel like they will split at the heart. She and Laura never talk about these moments. But when Hannah is plotting her escape, she is not going alone. Hannah's twin sister, Anna, often waits up for Hannah. She worries. She always has. She's a nervous woman. As a child, she was a nervous girl. Their mother, before she left, liked to say that Hannah got all the sisu, the fierce strength that should have been shared by both girls. Hannah and Anna always knew their mother didn't know them at all. They were both strong and fierce. Anna's husband worked at the paper mill in Niagara until some foreign company bought it and closed it, and then most people in town lost their homes because all the work that needed doing was already done. When Anna called, nervous as always, to ask if she and her family could stay with Hannah, she had not even posed the question before Hannah said yes. Hannah and Anna are not openly demonstrative, but they love each other wildly. In high school, Anna dated a boy who didn't treat her well. When Hannah found out, she put a good hurtin' on him. Hannah pretended to be her sister, and she took the bad boy up to the trails behind the county fairgrounds. She got down on her knees and started to give him head, and she told him if he ever laid a hand on her sister again. And before she finished that sentence, she bit down on his cock and told herself she wouldn't stop biting down until her teeth met. She smiled when she tasted his blood. He screamed so softly it made the hairs on her arms stand on end. Hannah still sees that boy around town once in a while. He's not a boy anymore, but he walks with a hitch and always crosses to the other side of the street when he sees her coming. On the nights when Hannah and Laura sit on the hood of Laura's car and kiss until their cold lips warm, Anna stands outside the front porch, shivering, waiting. Her cheeks flush. Her heart flutters around her chest awkwardly. Anna asks Hannah if she's seeing another man, and Anna tells her sister the truth. She says no, and Anna frowns. She knows Hannah is telling the truth. She knows Hannah is lying. She cannot quite figure out how she's doing both at the same time. The sisters smoke a cigarette together, and before they go in, Anna will place a gentle hand on Hannah's arm. She'll say, "Be careful." Hannah will kiss her twin's forehead, and she'll think, "I will." And Anna will hear her. How Hannah Ikonen knows it is time to get the girl and get out of town. Hannah and Anna's father, Red, lives in the basement. He's not allowed on the second floor where everyone sleeps. When Peter asks why, Hannah just shakes her head and says, "It's personal." She doesn't share personal things with her husband. Her father used to work in the mines. When the last copper mine closed, he didn't bother trying to learn a new trade. He started holding his back when he walked around, said he was injured. He collected disability, and when that ran out, he lived with a series of girlfriends who each kicked him out before long. Finally, when there was no woman in town who would give him the time of day, Red showed up on Hannah's doorstep, reeking of whiskey, his beard long and unkempt. He slurred an incoherent apology for being a lousy father. He begged his daughter to have mercy on an old man. Hannah wasn't moved by his plea, but she knew he would be her problem, one way or the other. She told him he could make himself comfortable in the basement, but if she ever saw him on the second floor, that would be that. It has been 15 years since the mine closed, but Red still calls himself a miner. The whereabouts of Hannah and Anna's mother, Ilsa, are unknown. She left when the girls were 11. It was a Thursday morning. Ilsa got the girls and their brothers ready for school, fed them breakfast, steel-cut oats topped with sliced bananas. She kissed them atop their pale blonde heads and told them to be good. She was gone when they returned home from school. For a while, they heard a rumor that Ilsa had taken up with a shoe salesman in Marquette. Later, there was news of her from Iron Mountain, a dentist's wife with a new family. Then there was no news at all. Hannah and Anna have 5 brothers scattered throughout the state. They are mostly bitter, lazy, indifferent, and unwilling to have a hand in the care and feeding of their father. When Hannah organized a conference call with her siblings to discuss the disposition of their father, the boys, as they are collectively known, said it was women's work, and if the twins didn't want to do that work, they could let the old man rot. One of the brothers, Ven, offered to send Hannah or Anna, whoever shouldered the burden of caring for Red, $20 a month. Simultaneously, the twins told him to stick it up his ass, and then they told the boys to go fuck themselves. After they hung up, Hannah called Anna, and Anna offered to take care of Red until he drank himself to death. But Hannah worried that death by drink would take too long. Anna had a child to raise, after all. It is an ordinary Tuesday when Hannah decides to go home after work at the cafe, instead of heading across the bridge to the institute to play make-believe with college boys. She can feel grease oozing out of her pores, and what she wants more than anything is to soak in a clean bathtub in an empty house. When she pulls into her driveway and sees Anna pacing back and forth in front of the garage, Hannah knows there will be no bath or empty house today. She parks the car, takes a deep breath, and joins her sister, who informs Hannah that their mother is sitting on the Salvation Army couch in the living room drinking a cup of tea. Hannah thinks, of course she is. How Hannah met and married Peter Lottie. Anna fell in love when she was 17. His name was Logan, and he lived on the reservation in Baraga. She loved his long black hair, and his smooth brown skin and the softness of his voice. They met at a football game, and the day after graduation, they married and moved. When Anna left, Hannah was happy for her sister, but she also hoped beyond all hopes that her sister and her new husband would take her with them. She could have said something. Years later, Hannah realized she should have said something, but she became the one who stayed. She got an apartment of her own and started hanging out at the university, sitting in on the classes she couldn't afford. Peter lived in the apartment next door, and back then he worked as a truck driver hauling lumber downstate, so dating him was fine because he wasn't around much. After a long trip, when Peter was gone for 3 weeks, he showed up at Hannah's door, his hair slicked back, beard trimmed, wearing a button-down shirt and freshly pressed jeans. In one hand, he held a cheap bouquet of carnations. He had forgotten that Hannah had told him on their first date that she hated carnations. He thrust the flowers into Hannah's hands, invited himself into her apartment, and said, "I miss you so much. Let's get married." Hannah, elbow deep into a bottle of wine at that point, shrugged. Peter, an optimist at heart, took the gesture as a response in the affirmative. They married not long after in a ceremony attended by Anna and her husband Red and three of the boys. No one from Peter's family attended. His mother was scandalized. Her boy would marry any child of Red Ekonen. How Red Ekonen got his reputation. Red Ekonen had mining in his blood. His daddy and his daddy's daddy had been miners up in Calumet when mining was something that mattered up there. And the town was rich, and every Sunday the churches were full of good folks grateful for the bounties of the hard earth. As a boy, Red loved his father's stories about the world beneath the world. By the time it was Red's turn to head underground, there wasn't much mining left to do, and that was a hell of a cross to bear. He was like a soldier without a war. Red started drinking to numb his disappointment. He married a pretty girl, had 5 handsome boys and 2 lovely girls, and continued drinking to celebrate his good fortune. The pretty girl left, and he drank so he wouldn't feel so lonesome. Finally, drinking was the only thing he knew how to do, so that's just what he did. He was a tall man, 6'7", and he had a loud voice and no sense of how to act right. That sort of thing just wasn't in him. There wasn't a bar in town where Red hadn't started a fight, or done something untoward with his woman, or someone else's woman. Things had gotten so bad, he needed to drive over to South Range or Chassel to drink with the old guys at the VFW, who really were soldiers without a war, because no one in town wanted to serve him a drink. When the boys were still in town, bartenders would call and have one of them come get their father. By the time Red Ekonen was drinking so he wouldn't feel so lonesome, he had become a mean drunk. He never had a kind word for his boys who drove miles into the middle of the night to bring their drunk daddy back home. One by one, the boys left home, tried to get as far away from their father as possible, until it was only the twins left, and then he started doing untoward things with them. And it was a small town, so people talked, and it wasn't long before no one at all wanted a thing to do with Red Ekonen. How Laura and Hannah became best friends. Laura Coppi grew up next door to the Ekonens. For a while in high school, she dated one of the boys, but then he moved away, went to college, and didn't bother to take her with him. Laura was, in fact, a friend to both Hannah and Anna throughout high school. When Anna and Logan moved down to Niagara, Laura saw how lost Hannah was without her twin. She decided to do her best to take Anna's place. Hannah was more than happy to let her. They became best friends, and then they became more than friends. But they never talked about it because there wasn't much to be said on the subject. How Hannah reacts when she sees her mother for the first time in 16 years. Before they go inside, Anna reaches for Hannah's waiting hand. They both squeeze, hard, their knuckles cracking, and then the twins go inside. Ilsa Ikonen is sitting on the edge of the couch. She is a small woman with sharp features. She has always been beautiful, and neither time nor distance has changed that. Her hair is graying around the scalp. Her features hang a bit lower, but she doesn't look a day over 40. Red is sitting where he always sits during the day, in the recliner next to the couch, staring at his estranged wife. He has tucked in his shirt, but his hands are shaking, because he's trying not to drink. He wants to be clear-headed, but his wife is so damned beautiful that, with or without the drink, he doesn't know up from down. Peter is sitting next to Ilsa, also staring, because the resemblance between his wife and her mother is uncanny. They have never met. Anna's husband, Logan, is sitting next to Peter, holding their son half asleep in his lap. He is deliberately avoiding any eye contact with his mother-in-law. He is helping his wife with the burden of her anger. As soon as Hannah and Anna enter the room, their stomachs churn. Beads of sweat slowly spread across their foreheads. Ilsa leans forward, setting her teacup on the coffee table. She smiles at her daughters. Hannah thinks, "Why did you offer her tea?" Anna thinks, "I was being polite." Hannah bites her lip. "What are you doing here, Ilsa?" she asks. Ilsa Ikonen uncrosses her legs and folds her hands in her lap. "It has been a long time," she says. Hannah looks at all the broken people sitting in her living room on her broken furniture, looking to her to fix their broken lives. She turns around and walks right back out the front door. Anna makes her excuses and rushes after her sister. She finds Hannah holding on to the still warm hood of her car, hunched over, throwing up. Anna's stomach rolls uncomfortably. When Hannah stands up, she wipes her lips with the back of her hand and says, "I mean, really?" How Laura finally convinces Hannah to run away with her. Hannah sits in her car until Ilsa Ikonen takes her leave and gets a room at the motel down the street. After her mother leaves, Hannah drives to campus and goes to the dank room of one of her college boys. She lies on his musty, narrow twin bed and stares at the constellation of glow-in-the-dark stars on the ceiling while the boy awkwardly fumbles at her breasts with his bony fingers. She sighs, closes her eyes, thinks of Laura. Afterward, when the boy is fast asleep, his fingers curled in a loose fist near his mouth, Hannah slips out of bed and heads back across the bridge to Laura's house. Laura smiles when she opens her front door. Hannah shrugs and stands in the doorway, her cheeks numb, still nauseated. She shoves her small hands into her pockets, tries to ignore the cold. Laura wraps her arms around herself, shifts quickly from one foot to the other. "Why don't you come in?" Hannah shakes her head. "I can't do this anymore." Laura arches an eyebrow, and even though she is barefoot, she steps onto her snowy front porch. She gasps, steps onto Hannah's boots, slides her arms beneath Hannah's coat and around her waist. Laura lightly brushes her lips against Hannah's. Hannah closes her eyes. She breathes deeply. How Hannah falls even more in love with Laura than she thought possible. When Laura can no longer feel her toes, she says, "We'd better get inside before I get frostbite and I'm forced to spend the rest of my life hobbling after you." Hannah nods and follows Laura into her house. It is familiar, has looked mostly the same for the past 20 years, and in that there is comfort. Inside the foyer, amid coats and boots, a shovel, a knitted scarf, a bag of salt, Hannah sinks to the floor and sits cross-legged. Laura sits across from Hannah, extends her legs, resting her cold feet in Hannah's lap.
Do you want to tell me about it?
Hannah shakes her head angrily. My mother's back. I mean, really? She says.
Hannah doesn't go home. She calls Anna and assures her sister that she's fine. Anna doesn't ask where she is. She's starting to make sense of things. Hannah lets Laura lead her up the steep staircase lined with books. She lets Laura put her into a hot bath. She lets Laura wash her clean. She follows Laura to bed, and for the first time in months, she falls asleep in a mostly empty house. She thinks, this is everything I want. As Hannah sleeps, Laura calculates how much money she has saved, the tread on her tires, how far they will need to travel so that Hannah might begin to forget about the life she's leaving behind. It all makes Laura very tired. But then she looks at Hannah's lower lip, how it trembles while she's sleeping.
How it has always been.
The next morning, Laura hears the knocking at her front door. She wraps herself in a thin robe and takes one last look at Hannah, still sleeping, lower lip still trembling. Laura has always loved Hannah, even before she understood why her entire body flushed when she saw Hannah at school, or running around her backyard, or sitting on the roof outside her bedroom window. Dating one of the boys was a way to get closer to Hannah. Laura would kiss Hannah's brother and think of his sister, her smile, the way she walked around with her shoulder muscles bunched up. Being with the brother was not what Laura wanted, but she told herself it was enough. For the first time, Laura feels something unfamiliar in her throat. It makes her a little sick to her stomach. She thinks it might be hope. Downstairs, Anna is standing on the front porch, shivering. She has a splitting headache. When Laura opens the door, Anna quickly slips into the house. Anna squeezes Laura's hand and heads upstairs into Laura's bedroom. Anna crawls into bed behind her sister, wraps her arms around Hannah's waist. Hannah covers one of Anna's hands with hers. She's not quite awake yet.
Don't make me go back there, Hannah says hoarsely.
Anna tightens her arms around her sister, kisses Hannah's shoulder. Anna says, you have to go back to say goodbye. There is a confidence in Anna's voice that reassures Hannah. Hannah sighs, slowly opens her eyes. She sees Laura standing in the doorway. Hannah smiles.
You don't have to stand so far away, she says.
Laura grins and crawls into bed with the twins. Laura says, remember when we were kids and the three of us would lie on your roof at night during the summer to cool down? Both Hannah and Anna nod. The three women roll onto their backs and stare at the ceiling. Cracks and water stains. How it sags.
We were miserable even then, Laura says.
How Hannah finally confronts her mother. Where Hannah has always been the protector, Anna has always been the voice of reason, able to make the right choices between impossible alternatives. When they were girls and Hannah would plot retribution against anyone who had wronged the twins, it was Anna who would deter her sister from acting thoughtlessly. When Reddy Conan would stumble into their room drunk, and Hannah would try to stab him with a kitchen knife or bite his ear off, it was Anna who grabbed her sister's arm and said, it's him or Superior Home. It was Anna who would sing to her father and stroke his beard and soothe all the meanness out of him. In these moments, Hannah would feel so much anger inside her, she thought her heart would rip apart. But then she would let the knife fall to the floor. Or she would unclench her teeth because anything was better than Superior Home, the state facility, where motherless children were often discarded until they turned 18. They heard stories bad enough to make them believe there were worse things than the stink of Reddy Conan's breath against their cheeks as he forgot how to behave like a proper father.
Anna held Hannah's hand as they walked back to their house, a bracing wind pushing their bodies through the snow. Hannah tried to breathe, but found the air thin and cold, and it hurt her lungs. As they climbed the porch stairs, Hannah stopped, leaned against the railing, her body heavy.
"I don't feel so good," she said.
Anna pressed the cool palm of her hand against Hannah's forehead. "You get to leave soon," she said. "Hold on to that." Hannah stared at her sister. She said,
"Come with us, you and Logan and the baby."
Anna shook her head.
"It's my turn to stay."
"Bullshit! We've taken our turns long enough." The front door opened. Peter glared at the twins. "Where the hell were you last night?" He grabbed Hannah by the elbow, pulling her into the house, and she let him. She wanted to save what fight she had left. In the living room, the scene closely resembled the tableau Hannah stumbled into the previous day, with Ilse Ikonen sitting on the couch, poised regally like she had never left, and had no need to offer acts of contrition. Hannah tried to squirm free from Peter's grasp, and he finally relented when calmly, quietly, Anna said, "Let go of my sister." Peter held a natural distrust of twins. It wasn't normal, he thought, for there to be two people who were so identical. He also harbored no small amount of jealousy for the relationship twins shared. While he was not a bright man, Peter was smart enough to know he would never be as close to his wife as he wanted. The twins stood before their father, their mother, their husbands. They stood in the house where they had grown up, filled with broken people and broken things. Anna thought, "This is the last time we will ever stand in this room." And Hannah suddenly felt like she could breathe again. She tried to say something, but she couldn't find her voice. Her throat was dry and hollow. The twins looked at their parents and thought about everything they had ever wanted to say to two people so ill-suited for doing right by their children.
"I'm sorry to intrude,"
Ilse said, her voice tight, her words clipped. She crossed her legs and fidgeted with a big diamond ring on her left hand.
"I wanted to see how you girls and the boys were doing. Perhaps explain myself."
Anna shook her head.
"Explanations aren't necessary," she said. "Your leaving is a long time gone."
Hannah removed her wedding ring and dropped it on the coffee table. Peter sneered and said, "Whatever." And Hannah rolled her eyes.
The twins stood before their father, their mother, their husbands. They sucked in a great mass of air, threw their shoulders back. They had rehearsed this moment more than once,
but then they realized that with all the time and wrongs gone by, there was nothing worth saying. How Hannah, Laura, Anna, Logan, and the baby got away. They piled into Laura's truck, their belongings packed tightly into a small trailer hitched to the back. They sat perfectly still, held their breaths, looked straight ahead. Requiem for a Glass Heart. The stone thrower lives in a glass house with his glass family. He is a flesh and blood man going about the business of living with his glass wife and glass child, their glass furniture and glass lives. The stone thrower, a good yet flawed man given to overindulgence, met his wife on a beach after a lightning storm, on a night when the sky refused to surrender to darkness, and yet there were stars up above. He saw the small fissure her body made in the sand first, moved closer, moved carefully. Then he saw her, her body bathed in moonlight, her eyes shining brightly. He instantly fell in love because he could not believe what lay before him. Her beauty was so mystifying and entrancing that it pierced through his skin and into his blood and wove itself tightly around his heart. He did not think about what it would mean to love a glass woman. He fell to his knees. He took her hand in his, turned the palm over. He gently placed his lips against the tender spot between her thumb and forefinger. He closed his eyes and inhaled deeply. He prayed that when he opened his eyes, she would still be there. When he did, she was. The stone thrower's wife instantly fell in love, because the stone thrower was everything she was not. He was the first man who did not see through her. He helped her to her feet, and then they walked for hours and miles more. He listened and enjoyed her husky voice as she told him all of her hopes, her dreams, her fears. She tried to keep some secrets for herself, but couldn't. His propensity for indulgence was infectious. She laid herself bare and did not think about what it would mean to love a man of flesh. The stone thrower and his wife courted for 7 months and married on the 7th day of that 7th month. She wore a silver gown and diamonds in her glass hair. The stone thrower stood next to her in front of his friends, their families. They vowed to love, to honor, to protect, to obey, although he did not yet know how he would keep his word. When the stone thrower and his glass wife make love, she is always on top, her cool glass hands pressed against his chest. She lies down on top of him, leg to leg, breast to chest, face to face. He kisses her long, slender neck, the hollow spaces above her clavicles. He slides his hands along the length of her glass hair, then holds her face, tracing her lips with his thumbs. The stone thrower's wife warms to his touch, just slightly, and though he can't see it, he can feel her body respond. He enjoys the pressure of her glass thighs trembling against his, and the way she breathes into his mouth, shallow and fast. When the stone thrower's wife comes, her body fogs in a random pattern outward from her heart. As she catches her breath, she can often hear her heart threatening to implode with the high-pitched lamentation of glass succumbing to pressure. When she's certain her heart won't break, she rolls onto her side, and the stone thrower lovingly traces lines in the condensation he has left behind. Sometimes after they make love, the stone thrower will light a candle, sit against the headboard, holding his wife in his arms, her glass spine arched against his thick, matted chest. He'll look down at his seed, slowly sliding out of her. He asks her to lay herself bare further, to share secrets he does not yet know. He has become accustomed to seeing too much, and now yearns to know too much. She often acquiesces, speaking softly, exposing herself in complicated ways. The stone thrower smiles. His wife does not. Every morning, the stone thrower sits across from his glass wife at their glass table, and he watches as orange juice sluices down her glass throat into her glass stomach. She rarely bothers with clothes when the drapes are closed, feels she has nothing to hide. It is a remarkable thing, the stone thrower often thinks, being able to see such intimacies, being able to see the separation of her whole into parts. She'll look at him, then to the distance, her cheeks growing warm while she remembers the night before. As they discuss the coming day, the stone thrower's wife will reach across the table and take his hand in hers. She'll trace the calluses, the fingers that are bent but not broken. He'll squeeze back, gently, ever careful not to break her. After the stone thrower and his glass wife share breakfast, he takes his glass child to school, holding the boy's cool, translucent hand in his. He listens carefully as the boy tells him about his hopes, his dreams, his fears. With every word his son speaks, the stone thrower feels his heart expanding, nearly breaking the cage of bone protecting it. After he kisses the boy on the forehead, sending him on his way, the stone thrower will sometimes stand just outside the child's classroom, peering inside, holding his breath, hoping that the other children will be gentle and kind, however fragile such hope may be. During the day, The stone thrower's glass wife busies herself with the work of living in a glass house. Room by room, she uses salt.